Good evening. Thank you for joining us tonight for Congressman Mike Capuano's telephone community meeting. My name is Allison, and I'd like to welcome you on the call tonight. If you'd like to ask Congressman Capuano a question at any point this evening, just press star 3. If you miss any portion of tonight's discussion, we will post an audio file of the meeting on our website. To access that file or to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit capuano.house.gov. If you have a question for Congressman Capuano tonight, please press star 3. And with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Congressman Capuano.
Thanks, Allison. I want to welcome everybody to the call tonight. I apologize. We're a few minutes later than we had anticipated, but we had votes on the floor of the House, and that's obviously has to take precedence. Basically, this call is just to check in with people. We just went through a very difficult and heart-wrenching election for a lot of people. I know that there's an awful lot of concerns out there, and I thought I wanted to talk to people and give everybody an opportunity to ask questions about what the future might hold. And I will start off by telling you that a lot of the questions you might ask, I probably don't know the answers to. But nonetheless, I'm happy to offer you my thinking on them and how things might proceed. Obviously, Massachusetts did not vote for Donald Trump, or the 7th District did not vote for Donald Trump, but he's our president. And there is much of me who shares many of the concerns that everybody has expressed to me. Nonetheless, elections are meant to avoid a more difficult way to change government. Donald Trump won the election, and I think we have an obligation as Americans to give him an opportunity. Some of the appointments he has made have raised just as many concerns with me as they have with some of my constituents. But he still is a president, and I can always hope that people are maybe act differently once they're in office than maybe some of the rhetoric that they spin during an election. But we'll see. And if things go as badly as some fear, we'll fight with every ounce of our strength. If they are better than we had feared, I'm happy to tell people that this is better than I had anticipated. Anyway, with that, we do begin a four-year session with the new president that, again, people have concerns about, and I'm here to listen and here to share my insights, whatever they might be. And with that, I think I'm going to stop my introductory comments and simply open up the lines to see if people have questions or comments. Whatever's on your mind, I am happy to discuss for the next hour.
And we do have some callers on the line with questions. If you're just joining us and you do have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3. And our first question comes from Miriam, who would like to talk about Medicare. Miriam, when you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm very concerned with the talk about dissolving Medicare and replacing it with some kind of vouchers. I think that's a terrible idea. I think Medicare has served people very well for many years, and I would like to know what we can do to ensure that Medicare continues to provide the kind of coverage that it does today.
Thanks, Mary. First of all, I think you're right to have that concern. I think this is one of the undiscussed or under-discussed issues of the election, particularly with Paul Ryan. The so-called Ryan budget has contained that provision now for years. And for some reason, I think that they've gotten a pass on it because I don't know why, but they have. All I can tell you is I think you're right to be concerned. You're right to be alert. At the same time, I find it difficult to think that they will actually just completely privatize it and completely voucherize it. Every time they've tried that, the American people have stood up tall and screamed loud enough that they had to back off. Nonetheless, there are other ways to do it. There are 1,000 ways to skin a cat, and voucherization obviously is one of them. That's the more obvious one. That's in through the front door. And I think that I want to caution people to watch out for any attacks through the side door or through the window. There are ways to nick and chip away at Medicare that may not kill it right away, but it'll kill it for the future. And since I agree with you that Medicare has been one of the greatest programs ever invented by any government, we need to save it. We need to make sure that it's there for our children, knowing full well that it can be improved and knowing full well it is not the perfect proposal, but it's better than what was there before, which was nothing. So, Miriam, I share your concerns. But I need to ask you to stay vigilant. I need you to stay vocal, very vocal, and to understand that this is not the first time that people have made proposals, but this is one of the many that I hope that their rhetoric was stronger than their actual actions. But we'll find out within the next year or so because, I mean, first they need a so-called repeal the Affordable Care Act, which is much easier said than done. And I don't mean by pure votes. I mean by substance. The Obamacare, as it's called, has gotten a lot of negative press, and a lot of people say they hate it. And there are some provisions that a lot of us didn't like when we voted for it. There's some provisions that have come up since then that we don't like. But there are many, many provisions in that bill that many Americans love. And if they simply repeal it, I think they'll find out very quickly that that's not what America wants. But, Miriam, I share your concerns. I will remain vigilant. And all I can ask for is, number one, is your prayers to make sure that they don't do it. And number two is to stay vigilant with as many friends as you can across the country to make sure that if they do try, that we have the strength and the courage to stand up against it.
If you're just joining us and you have a question for Congressman Capuano tonight, please press star 3. Our next caller is Elizabeth, who has a question about mass incarceration. Elizabeth, when you're ready.
Hi, Congressman Capuano. I'm calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. And my question is about mass incarceration and the war on drugs. I'm very concerned about the rhetoric that Donald Trump spouted during the campaign, raising a lot of racial concerns. And I'm wondering what you plan to do to fight the system of mass incarceration and the war on drugs that unfairly targets people of color.
Well, I think, again, you raise a good concern, but I think a lot of the vote, not just in Massachusetts, but I don't know the exact number, I think it was like 11 states, just passed the similar law on marijuana that we passed. And I think a lot of it had to do with exactly this issue, that a lot of us felt that, you know, I don't smoke dope and all that stuff, but I don't want anybody arrested for doing it, if that's what they want to do, as long as they're not driving a vehicle and all that. And I think that's the beginning. I will tell you that last year, I thought we had a hope of getting some significant criminal justice reform. Not because those of us from Massachusetts have been asking for it, which we had, but because we had finally been joined by some of the right-wing evangelical groups that have come to the conclusion that our judicial system is unfair and overly harsh to some people. And again, I want to be real clear. I mean, there are violent criminals that need to be treated harshly, but that is not who we're talking about. We're talking about the nonviolent people that make mistakes and are not a threat to anyone. They need to be punished. I get that, but not the kind of punishment we've been dishing out for years now. And I will tell you this from day one, I don't think I've ever voted for a bill that has mandatory minimums in it for the very simple reason that takes away the discretion to mete out punishment depending on the circumstances. And it ends up in too many people being incarcerated that don't need to be there. So I will tell you that we haven't made legislative progress, but I think we have made some moral progress with the evangelical groups to look at the issue in a more thoughtful way. I think the American people, by voting for laws such as the legalization of marijuana, I think a big part of that is America's desire to get over the so-called war on drugs, well, maybe focus on maybe drugs that are more dangerous than this. And I'm concerned about it, but I have to be honest, I don't think this is going to be a major problem. I mean, again, if they don't do something, our jails are over full, and they're going to either have to build a lot more jails, which is financially unfeasible for most states, or to start letting people out who really do deserve to be in jail. And I think that that's not tenable. So I believe that the people that wouldn't normally think of these issues, they may be on our side for the wrong reasons, but I think they're on our side. But again, getting from where we are to where we need to be, it's still a long journey. But I appreciate the question, and I share your concerns.
If you'd like to ask Congressman Capuano a question tonight, please press star 3. Jessica is joining us now with a question about presidential appointments. Jessica, when you're ready.
Hello, Congressman. My question is, as a private citizen, what is the best way that I can influence presidential appointments, which are non-legislative decisions? Thank you.
I'm sorry to tell you, Jessica, there's not a whole lot that we can do. Most of us spoke out loudly when Bannon was appointed to White House advisor, I think his official title is, because of his past actions, his past commentary, his past divisiveness, and most of us think racism and anti-Semitism and all kinds of things. But it is the president's appointments, and this is part of what I keep telling people who say, well, you're all the same, or they say, well, elections don't matter, I only have one vote. elections matter a lot, and they do have consequences, and this is one of them. The president, any president, gets to appoint many people whom they want to appoint without approval, without the ability to review them. And that's the system we've had for 200 years. It's still the system we have with Donald Trump. So, therefore, there's not much we can do except to raise a cry when the wrong people or when the seriously wrong people get appointed, number one. And then number two is to keep a very close eye on them once they do get appointed. I think that there are many of us that are trying to sift through exactly how we can keep an eye on not just one or two appointments, but pretty much the entire administration for potential conflict of interest. I mean, thus far, the most appointments, I call them the team of rivals is what some people want to call them. I call them the team of billionaires so far. I think the risk of serious conflict of interest with the president, with his family, with many of the people he has appointed is very, very high. And I'm not talking about just a few minor conflict of interest by getting a friend a room at one of the Trump hotels. I'm talking potential conflict of interest of serious nature. But we'll have to wait and see, and I think the best thing we can do, again, is keep a very vigilant eye. But there is nothing legally that we can do about presidential appointees that do not require Senate approval.
Our next caller has a question about the community path. When you're ready, your question for the congressman. Hello?
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 Hi.
Hello?
Hi,
hello.
You have a question for...
This is Pauline Lim from Brick Bottom Artist Building in Somerville, Mass. And
hi,
I wanted to thank you for your longtime support of the community path, but I also am concerned that it's stalled, and I wanted to know if it will be possible to complete it so that people can commute all the way to Boston without getting severed in half like that guy in Porter Square did. So thank you.
Thanks, Pauline. The answer is, at the moment, not yet. I mean, it is, I'm sure, since you're asking the question, I assume you're familiar with the current redesign of it. Much of it is in good shape. There's some bumps in the road. There was one big problem with it when it gets up to the McGrath Highway area. You know, it has to go back out to the highway, and that's completely unacceptable. Yet, to be perfectly honest, I'm trying to have one fight at a time. And I'm trying to get the Green Line extension completed and get the last I dotted and the last T crossed. And the community path is amongst them. I actually met with Secretary Pollack today on the Green Line, and this was one of the discussion points. And she knows that, number one, it's a good project. I mean, the community path aspect is a good addition to the project. Of course, she supports the project. And number two, she knows that it's the highest priority we have for adding back things. I mean, I understand they had to scale back some of the stations and had to redesign some of these. That's all acceptable to me. It's not what I want, but it's acceptable. But that community path has to go for the very reasons you just said. Now, I bike, but I don't bike to work. And the truth is I drive on McGrath Highway pretty much every day I'm home to get to my office, and I want the bikers off of McGrath Highway as much as they want to be off McGrath Highway. It's safer for them. It's safer for the drivers, for the car drivers, and it's the right thing to do. And so I will tell you that it is the top priority to fix the Green Line proposal that's currently there, as far as I'm concerned, is the top priority. But first of all, we need to get the Green Line approved and then address fixing it. And I think that priority is shared by the state, but we're not there yet, and we still have to stay vigilant and stay very strong on them. You're right to be concerned. You're right to prioritize it. And all I can tell you is the people of Somerville and Cambridge have been very strong on this issue, and I think we need to continue that. But I feel it's not done. I feel very good about the Green Line extension. I don't feel that great about the full construction of the community path yet, but I'm very confident that it is the number one item on the agenda after the bigger picture of the Green Line itself. And that's so my job and your job is to keep it there and then push it as soon as the Green Line proposal is finally approved.
If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Maureen is joining us now with a question about health care. Maureen, your question for the congressman?
Hello, Congressman. Maureen. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to change my question a little bit because I think Miriam covered the topic about the health care and the Affordable Care Act. So the question that I wanted to ask was about, do you think that there could be retribution in terms of defense financing to Massachusetts because we did not vote for Donald Trump?
No, I don't think so. I mean, because those contracts are awarded on the basis of ability to get things done, and they're on the basis of cost. And to be perfectly honest, I don't know that there have been very many defense contracts. I mean, and Massachusetts does a lot of that work. Most of our defense work is technological, guidance systems, things like that. But that work is done because we do the best work in the world. And that's what they want on our ships and on our planes. They want the best equipment in the world, and it's made in Massachusetts. And so, therefore, no, I don't think so. Actually, though I will probably oppose any significant buildup in military spending, any significant buildup in military spending, at least economically, will probably be good for Massachusetts. So I'm not, though I'm aware of it, and, you know, I could be wrong, but at the moment, my estimation, my judgment at the moment is that we'll be perfectly fine.
Next caller is Barbara, who has a question related to sanctuary cities. Barbara, your question?
Yes, thank you very much, Congressman. I was wondering what your stance is on the possibility of an illegal alien being caught committing a crime, and whether he would be prosecuted or not prosecuted. Actually, do you consider Boston a sanctuary city?
I think Boston is a sanctuary city, but that is not the way the sanctuary city is, to my knowledge, has ever been utilized in Massachusetts. I don't know about other states. I was an alderman in Somerville when we passed our ordinance, and all the ordinance says is it's very clear. It has nothing to do with people who have committed crimes. It simply says, if a local police officer stops you for almost always a traffic violation, or maybe jaywalking, whatever it might be, the typical minor traffic violations, and they run you, if the only other issue is that you have some status issues, they may not prioritize it. But if it pops up that you're also wanted for a bank robbery or domestic violence or whatever it might be, you get arrested. And that was always the way it was. Now, if it's not being utilized that way, that would be news to me, number one. Number two, I would oppose it. Violent criminals or criminals, serious criminals, are serious criminals regardless of their immigration status. And that was never what Sanctuary City was intended, at least not when I was an alderman, and certainly not the way it was imposed when I was mayor of Somerville. I can't speak to the details of all the cities, but to my knowledge, that is the way they are still done, in at least in Boston and Somerville and Cambridge and other places that have it. Today. So, therefore, anybody who gets stopped by any local police officer who is wanted for a criminal activity, such as bank robbery or, again, anything, they will be arrested and they will be prosecuted for that criminal activity. So, some of this has been, I believe, misrepresented by some of the media, or maybe it's done differently in other states. I don't know that. But certainly in Massachusetts, to the best of my knowledge, the way it's done is that way. So, to me, I don't have any problem with that. I think it's simply a matter of local prioritization or police resources. Not every cop makes a judgment every minute of every day. They don't stop everybody going over the speed limit. They only stop those people who are speeding the fastest. Even when they stop people for going over the speed limit, they don't write everybody a ticket. Some people they let go. So there is a judgment made at every level of, and then when if they do write a ticket, a court clerk could say, well, we're going to let this person go, and we're going to make this person pay a fine. That's the way the system has always worked. I can't imagine taking away that ability to make some judgment calls at the spur of the moment. And that being the case, right now, sanctuary cities are imposed in my district, that as far as I know, they don't trouble me at all. And if the federal government takes action upon it, we will see what happens when that happens.
If you're just joining us and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Jean Ann is joining us now with a question about Rutherford Ave traffic. Jean Ann?
Yes, good evening. My question is, what's the situation with the Rutherford Avenue Sullivan Square corridor, and then reference with the Bunker Hill project, which is going to be a very, very big build out with more traffic. And I'd also like to thank you and Danny Ryan for your efforts on behalf of the people of Charlestown thus far.
Yeah. I can tell you that now that the casino issue has been settled, I know that the Rutherford Ave, Sullivan Square area, I believe, is very well slated to get significant improvement, and this is part of the discussion. I've been pretty public from day one that my definition of improvements to Rutherford Ave will not move traffic onto Main Street or onto Bunker Hill Ave or on Medford Street. That's not improvement. That's a worsening of the situation. The current Rutherford Ave, if you've been there for any length of time, Gina, you know, was built in order to take traffic out of the residential neighborhoods of Charlestown and drive it around Charlestown. And it's done it successfully. Now, does it need to be rehabbed? Of course it does. Can it be significantly improved? Absolutely. That's the widest street around. There's a lot of things we could do to make it a better street, make it more traffic-friendly, make it bike-friendly, make it pedestrian-friendly. And I really think I would love to be part of that discussion. And I think it's going to happen. That's number one. As far as the construction in Charleston, I know there has been some recent deep concerns, and I think reasonable concerns about overdevelopment and overcrowding. That's something that the community is going to have to deal with. As you mentioned, State Representative Danny Ryan and others have been deeply involved with listening to people and trying to figure out what's the best way to go forward. And I think that's a decision most appropriately left to the people of Charlestown to make that decision. And basically, I will do whatever the people of Charlestown want me to do relative to development. I don't want to be told how to live in my neighborhood, and I certainly wouldn't presume to tell people of Charlestown the type of neighborhood they want to live in. But so whatever they want is what I'm going to support. As far as traffic goes, the traffic on Rutherford Ave is there. It is through traffic from a lot of residential, from a lot of suburban people. I don't want it running through the residential neighborhoods of Charlestown. I prefer to run it around it. Therefore, in my opinion, I think Rutherford Ave has to be treated as a major through artery, which it is. And if it's treated any other way, then if that's what Charlestown wanted, that'd be fine. It's not what I've heard. I don't believe that anybody needs any more traffic on Main Street or Bunker Hill Ave.
Next caller is Ed with a question about the president-elect and his family businesses. Ed, when you're ready. Ed, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. I'm very concerned about the business interests that Mr. Trump or President-elect Trump has, and whether or not we are going to have issues. Already there's a reception at his hotel in Washington with, I believe, Baran hosting it. The money that is being paid obviously is going to the Trumps. What is Congress going to do to oversee this issue?
It's hard to say what Congress is going to do. Don't forget, Congress is run by Republicans right now. It's unlikely that anybody should expect them to run roughshod over their own president. Well, we'll see. But I will tell you that there are a lot of people keeping as close an eye as possibly can be done on conflicts of interest. Now, I, for one, I totally agree. I'm not interested in nickel and diming it in the sense that, for the sake of discussion, if somebody rents a room out of the Trump Hotel that shouldn't have been there, it may not be right, but I'm just not going to lose a lot of sleep over it. It's the other major conflicts of interest that bother me, potential development interests, potential interest. There are scenarios. Let's say some Chinese billionaire doesn't want to bribe anybody but wants to buy a Trump building for, you know, three times its worth. On one hand, and on the other hand, might want a contract to do something for the government. And we're talking hundreds of millions and billions of dollars. I don't want to presume. I'm not going to begin this process thinking that the Trumps are criminals. I won't do that. However, you know, human nature is what it is, and, you know, and money is money. I think it's appropriate for us to keep a very close eye on all this. I do think that this particular presidential situation, because of the complications of his current business, do raise more questions and do demand closer scrutiny. And I think they're going to get it, to be perfectly honest. I don't want to start by presuming that the president and his family will go out of their way to create corruption. But I do know that there are people out there that might want to create corruption without them knowing it. So that's what conflict of interest is all about. I mean, it's not about really stopping the recipient of it from being a criminal. It's from stopping others from doing criminal matters without anybody knowing it. So all that being said, I don't think you can expect Congress to do much because Republicans control the House, Republicans control the Senate. But I do know that there will be a lot of both members of Congress and outside groups that do this pretty much professionally and have been pretty bipartisan along the ways. And so at the moment, that's part of the discussion going on here is how do we do this? This is a, well, honestly, let's be honest, this is a new situation for all of us. And We've never had a president with this type of complicated business entity before they came to office, and we're going to struggle with it.
If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3. Caitlin is joining us now with a question about climate change. Caitlin, your question?
Hi, thank you very much, Congressman. I just wanted to address climate change. I'm very concerned based on the rhetoric from the Trump campaign and also who he is surrounding himself with by appointments. He seems to be a pretty big climate change denier, which I find very alarming. So I just wanted to know if there are any plans in place on your end to address this.
Well, again, I want to apologize up front. I think you've already heard this a lot, and you're going to continue to hear this a lot tonight. Elections have consequences. Trump was pretty clear that he doesn't believe that climate change is a problem. Now, to be perfectly honest, interestingly enough, if I remember correctly, since he won the election, he actually made a comment that something along the lines that he did accept the fact that human activity has something to do with climate issues. Now, I think most of us have watched this closely enough already to know that whatever he says one day, he might say something different the next day. So all that being said, I'm awaiting to see who he appoints to the EPA and other such places to see how serious he is about any of these things. But all I can tell you is this is one of the many issues, this one being one of the more open and more public one, because the president-elect was so clear about his opinions, that you're right to be concerned. We've struggled to make progress. I think in the last couple of years, the average American has accepted the fact that we need to do something about climate change because it does have a human aspect to it. We still have struggled with exactly what we should do. There's no magic answer here. But I share your concerns that this election might result in a setback to that, but it's not going to kill it. And it won't kill it because it is real. I believe in science. I don't believe in theory. I believe in the science. And all the scientists I know agree that there is a human element to it. And number two, I also believe that even if you're not sure, it doesn't do any harm to make the environment better and to do whatever we can to improve it. Even if humans didn't make it bad, which I don't accept, but even if that's what you believe, what's wrong with cleaner air? What's wrong with cleaner water? It's good for us. It's good for our children. And by the way, it creates pretty good jobs. So I personally don't see a downside to it. And so therefore, if you embrace the business aspect of it, not just the emotional and scientific aspect to it, I think it could be okay. But again, I think you're very right to be concerned about this administration. And I think we'll know pretty soon how good or how bad it might be. I think this is one that we'll probably know within a few months. And that's all I can tell you is whatever happens, we're not going to back down and we're not going to give up. It may be a temporary setback, but it's not going to go away and it's not going to magically fix itself. So that being the case, even if we can't make progress in the next few years, we'll be around to try to make progress as soon as the opportunity presents itself.
Our next caller is Molly with a question about community involvement. Molly, your question?
Hi, my name is Molly. I'm calling from the Elston-Brighton area. I'm 28 years old, and I think there are a lot of people kind of my age group and a lot of other people who, since the election, really want to become more politically involved and have kind of realized that their voice is more important than they may have realized. So I just wanted to find out from you some concrete things we can do, whether it's other newsletters to sign up for, whether it's calls or protests, things like that. What's the best way for us to kind of exercise our civic duties?
Well, first of all, Molly, thank you. I really appreciate both your commitment and the comments, because I do think it's not new that younger people tend to not get involved. And to be perfectly honest, I'm older than you. In my generation, young people were involved for one reason only, and that was the Vietnam War and the possibility of being drafted. Once that issue is lifted, a lot of young people, it's not your generation, it's every generation, including mine, a lot of young people lost focus, and obviously young people tend to want things fixed tomorrow, and why can't you just do the right thing? But the fact that this election might have woken up an entire generation to say, oh my God, this matters, that could be really one of the best silver lining aspects of this whole election, number one. Number two, that commitment has to stay solid. It cannot be a one-day commitment. Say, oh, I'm going to go vote, and that's the end of it. No, 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 no. This is a lifelong commitment. And it doesn't mean you have to run for office. It means you have to stay involved. You have to stay vocal. You have to realize that there is a difference between one politician and another, and that your vote matters as much as anybody else's vote. I've heard numbers thrown around, depending who you listen to. But the concept is right. 100,000 votes out of 100 million would have changed the results of this election. And that's not the first time this can be said. That can be said for many elections just in the last 20 years. So that the more young people I can get to pay attention, the more young people that get concerned about this and say and can recommit themselves to being active both in elections, and I don't mean just presidential elections. I mean, we're going to have a House election and a Senate election in 2 years. We're going to have governorships elections. We're going to have state house and state representatives and state senators and city elections, and whether you like it or not, all of those things matter. And I know it's hard for people to understand that, but if the younger generation gets nervous about this and commits themselves to true activism, that's a great thing. And I think we'll be okay. Activism comes in many ways. Yes, being politically involved, but also be involved in the community so that when you do get politically involved, you're not just a stranger knocking on somebody's door. You know, go out and become a little league coach, and that way you get to meet all the parents and all the kids. And when it comes time, like everybody else, you talk to people and you convince them that way. And there's a thousand ways. Be active in the community. Be vocal in the community. Be vocal in your family. And it doesn't mean yell at people. But you know, when we just have Thanksgiving at family gatherings, if you have family members that need to be that raise your concern, you should speak up. I don't have to speak up by yelling at them or calling them dumb. That's what Trump has done, and I don't support that. But it does mean if somebody says, you know what, immigrants are bad people and I don't like immigrants, I think it's appropriate to say, excuse me, wait a minute, and here's what I think. Now, that may cause a family fight, but it also, if you don't challenge those things, if you let your coworkers and your friends get away with those things, they grow, and they grow a life of their own, and it becomes socially acceptable to do those kinds of things, to believe those things, and I think that's wrong. This is an argument and a struggle for the hearts and minds of the American people, and it doesn't just happen every 4 years. It happens every single day. And so, therefore, I can tell you, Molly, I really appreciate what you said. I really appreciate that. I hope that you're right about your generation is now woken up, and I look forward to their involvement because, you know, God knows we need them.
Next caller is Fernando with a question about airplane noise. Fernando, your question?
Yes, this is Fernando. I live here in the South End in Boston, and in the last year or two, actually, we have had a significant increase in airplane noise from the Logan Airport, specifically, I think, by the use of the runway 27. And I don't know what can be done about it, but it seems to me that it's not also the people in Milton have been complaining about that, but I think that's a different situation. They are complaining about airplanes landing, and we are really complaining about airplanes taking off over here. So I think the situation of Logan has to be studied better, and I don't know what the congressman can do to be able to help us and work with the FAA to see if we can resolve some of this airplane noise problems. We get woken up every morning at 6 or 5:30 in the morning with airplanes flying overhead. And this happens every day and maybe for 4 or 5 hours a day. So that is a problem for our neighborhoods over here in this area.
I appreciate it, Fernando. This is not a new issue, and it's not isolated to the South End. I mean, I live in Somerville, and I am at the end of runway 33, and we get planes on a regular basis, and they are low and they are loud. You're probably a little closer to the end of runway 27 than I am, but not by much. We get a lot of complaints about airplane noise the last couple of years because they have they've changed the way airplanes land and arrive. And take off, and I don't know how to describe it on the phone. They've narrowed the corridor. So if planes were coming in, or maybe if they were spread out a mile wide, now they're only spread out a couple hundred yards. So if you're under a flight path, you get more planes over your house than you used to. Not that there are more planes in the air. There aren't. There are a few more planes, but not many. But they're more concentrated in some areas. And to be perfectly honest, there's no way that that we can be satisfied doing this unless we close Logan Airport, and that's not a realistic answer. To me, the only way to do it is to be honest with people and say, look, we have planes. Logan Airport is there. It's a very important economic engine. It's not going away. The planes individually, in general, are quieter than they used to be, but that doesn't answer the question. The biggest thing we can do, as far as I'm concerned, is to get realistic with people and say everybody in an urban area benefits from Logan Airport, and therefore everyone should, within as best we can, share the pain of Logan Airport, and that's noise. So that being the case, what I have argued for is that the planes that are overhead should be spread out as much as possible. Now, that will help the people that are under those concentrated air paths, but it will then spread the pain, and now some people who don't get noise now will get some noise later. But the people who get a lot of noise now will have some degree of relief. And that's what we're working on. And to be perfectly honest, and there are other proposals too, getting the planes up higher more quickly. Maybe actually we're trying to get one of the planes, I think it's the A320, if I remember correctly, a small, relatively inexpensive redesign to quiet it. But, you know, even if we could do all of that, there's still going to be some plane noise in an urban area. My argument is just not the same people should suffer all the time. And I know that that will make some people happy. I also know it will make some people very unhappy because some people will say, I don't want any planes over my house. And my answer is, well, then if you don't get any, then I get them all. And that's not fair either. So all that being said, that's what we're working on. I will tell you that I feel comfortable that for the first time in a long time, we have an administration at Massport that is now working with us. The FAA is still a little bit of a problem, but they've been better. They are studying it. These things take a long time. It's like driving a ship, not a Ferrari. So it takes a long time to get them to change anything, but they are studying various options that can be done. I believe that, again, for the first time I've been in office, Massport is on our side, but they're not the ones that make that determination. It would be the FAA. And this study is being conducted now. They actually hired MIT to do it. And I'm hoping that when that's done, we'll be able to implement some of these changes that I know will help some, but it will probably hurt some other people. And no matter what you do, there's no answer to it because we have to have planes coming in out of Logan to have an economy that works. And all I can tell you is it's like trucks. Not everybody, it shouldn't be that all trucks go through one street. We all benefit from trucks and we all benefit from cars. And therefore, if we share the pain a little bit, it's not wonderful for anybody, but that's the price we pay for living in an urban area.
Nancy is joining us now with a question about bicycle safety. Nancy, your question?
Hi, Congressman. Thank you so much for being you. I can't deal with what's going on nationwide, but I've got a question about bicycle safety, or two questions, actually, about the bicycle safety. Isn't there some way that it can be required that bicyclists have proper lighting, good, strong, clear, bright lighting, front and back? I drive and am scared to death constantly when I'm out now. There's so many bikes, which are fine. I mean, I think it's great that people are using bicycles, but I can't see them. And this happens, I mean, you're going 15, 20 miles an hour now very carefully all the time, because so many people on bikes do not have lights, front or back, or they have them in only one place. And the second part of the question was, since there's so many bicyclists now, how about they absorbing some of the costs of maintaining the roads as those of us who drive cars do?
Well, let me answer the second part first. I mean, right now I think we have a problem across the nation in determining on actually finding money to fix our roads anywhere. And that is a national debate. Massachusetts just raised the gas tax, as have, I think, 30-some-odd states have done that in the last 2 years. The federal government refuses to raise any revenue to improve our infrastructure, and that is part of the problem. So that's number one. As far as bike safety, to be perfectly honest, let me give you a few statistics. Don't hold me the exact number, but this is roughly true. Boston is one of the top five cities in America for bicycle commuting, and that's more what we're seeing. So a lot of people take their bikes to work, but even as one of the top cities, we're less than 5% of the commuters take bicycles. 90% of the people still take other transportation. About 15 to 20% take transit, 2, 3, 4% walk, and the rest, I don't know, whatever that leaves, 60, 70% actually drive cars, which, again, we can complain about that all day long, but that's the reality of the situation. For me, first of all, any regulation on bicycling would probably be done at the state or local level, probably the state level. I think with the growing number of commuters on bikes and with the growing number of accidents that have happened, bicyclists getting killed and being injured, drivers being scared, as you've mentioned, you're not the first one that's mentioned to me. I drive a lot. I also ride a bike, and I'm scared on both, to be perfectly honest. A lot of cities are doing what they can to have separation, a lot of with bike lanes and the like. But I personally think we're almost at the point where we need to start thinking about licensing for bicyclists, because otherwise you can't enforce any of these rules. You can't. Most bicyclists are responsible bikers and obey the laws. But we have all seen there's a handful who don't, go through red lights, running through, zigzag through traffic. Now, that's not the majority, but it is. It angers everybody. It's dangerous, and it pits bicyclists against automobile people. And that's just, it's unnecessary, number one. But the only way to enforce that or to enforce lighting or enforce any safety like helmet laws or anything else, the only way to enforce it is to have some sort of a license like we do for automobiles. Otherwise, even if you see somebody doing exactly the worst possible thing, even if you want to report them, you can't. There's nothing to do. Even if a police officer wants to stop them, if they don't have any identification on them, they can lie. And then a cop has to decide, am I really going to arrest this person because they ran a red light on a bicycle? You know, that's not necessary. So all that being said, I think we are slowly getting to the point where bicyclists are probably going to have to go back to licensing. And I hate to tell you this, I'm old enough to remember when they used to make you have a license to have a bike. But those are the old days, and they're never really enforced. But that may be where we're at. If it continues to grow, which I think it will, and I hope it does. And if you heard earlier, we were talking about the community path. Well, the community path is really the most important part of it, is to allow bicyclists to get off of McGrath Highway, that particular community path. And for me, I firmly believe that we should have as many separated accesses to downtown Boston for bicyclists as we can get, both for their safety and for the convenience of automobile drivers. All that being said, I still believe that most of that regulation is going to have to be done at the state level, maybe the local, but probably the state level. And I hope people stop thinking about it, because other than that, all the good bicyclists out there will be held to the standard of the worst offenders, and the battle will continue. And I don't think that it's something that most people want to battle. Most people are happy to share the road. As you said, it's great that people are taking bikes to work. But if that's the case, if it's going to grow, and really grow, and be safe for everybody, there has to be a way to enforce whatever rules we do have, and I can't think of any other way to do it. If there are other ways, I'm certainly open to it. But, again, it is more than likely a state issue and not a federal one.
Chris is joining us now with a question about Republican plans for the Affordable Care Act. Chris, your question?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, now that Republicans are in control of both houses and the presidency, I'm assuming we're going to have to deal with more of a push from them to change the health care law, Affordable Care Act. Is there anything that you think we should expect from them? Have they proposed any serious replacements for the law? And do you have any idea what we can expect and how we could expect to see the best and what we can do to help protect the best parts of the Affordable Care Act and lose as little of it as possible? Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Those questions are the same questions we're asking. I mean, it's kind of funny. The Affordable Care Act is one of those things that I don't think any individual would have written that law and supported it. But that's not the way laws get written. They get written by 435 House members, 100 senators, and a president writing laws. And therefore, when you have that many cooks in the kitchen, you always end up with a mess. On every single law that's ever passed, it starts out messy. And then we have to clean it up over the next 5, 10, 15 years. And the ACA is no different. There are many provisions in the law that I did not like the day I voted for it. And I said so pretty vocally. I have them, but I think it's still up on my website. And there are some that have happened since then that I didn't foresee that I don't like. But in general, I love the law because I do believe that America should have health care for all. I do believe that. All that being said, it's been interesting to me that for the last, 4 years now, ever since we passed, 6 years, whatever it is, we've passed it, every single word out of the mouths of the Republicans has been repeal it, repeal it, repeal it. And then they started repeal and replace. They have never once, not one single Republican has ever written down their proposal of what they would replace it with. And that includes President-elect Trump. All that being said, I have the exact same questions you have, and I think that it's going to be a very difficult place for them politically, because with all the rhetoric they've had, they are now expected to repeal it. But they've been slowly, quickly, actually, backing off that commitment and now saying, well, we're going to repeal some parts of it. I don't know how they repeal the sections that people don't like, and most of those have to do with who's paying for this, and then keep the sections that people do like, and that requires payment. How do you have a law that costs money and then don't raise money to pay for it? And if you do, that's so fiscally irresponsible, it's ridiculous. So we'll have to wait and see. And it's obviously one of the most important and one of the biggest issues that they're going to face relatively quickly. And I think we'll know whatever their plans are come January.
Next caller is Matthew, who has a question about your plans for committee work in the upcoming Congress. Matthew?
Thank you, Congressman Capuano. I really enjoyed this call. You sit on a number of committees in the House, Committee on Ethics, Financial Services, Transportation, Infrastructure, and you're a ranking member of, I believe, one subcommittee. Could you talk specifically about the bills that you're proposing in those subcommittees that you feel are especially important for the upcoming congressional session, and any that need public support, and why?
Thanks, Matthew. You checked me out. You know too much. a lot of work does get done in committees, and we'll have our proposal. We've had numbers of proposals over the years on 1,000 different things, particularly in the Financial Services Committee, because that's the one that needs the most protection. But I will be honest with you, my focus in the next 2 years is on defense. I'm fearful that my Republican colleagues, now that they control the House, the Senate, and the White House, will be attacking all of the issues that I care about. Especially our financial services. They'll be attacking the Consumer Protection Finance Bureau. They'll be attacking the Fed. They'll be attacking all federal regulators, the SEC. The people that are just put in charge of the SEC is just very dangerous as far as I'm concerned. And I say that knowing that most of America doesn't pay attention to this level of detail, nor should they, but I have to. And I will tell you that my expectation on the next 2 years is to be Democrats are in no position to be proactive and propose bills. I'll do some because that's what we do. I got some things on the Fed. I got some things on health care. I've got some things on education, a lot of things on ethics and privacy. You know, those are my typical things I do. But I'm not silly enough to think that I can sit here today with a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican president thinking that my bills are going to get enacted. They're not. So that being the case, I'm not going to just sit here and be unrealistic. But I am going to do my best, and my focus mostly will be on protecting the gains that we have made to make sure that to basically minimize any damage they might try to do in the next couple of years.
We have time for just a couple more questions this evening, and if we did not get to your question, we do apologize. At the end of the telephone community meeting, you will have an opportunity to leave Congressman Capuano a voicemail. And our next question is from Jeffrey, who has a question related to President-elect Trump. Jeffrey, your question?
Yes, hello. My name is Jeff. I'm calling you from Alston. I'm very fearful that President Trump is going to propose various things which are much too radical for the American people. But President Trump is firmly entrenched for the next 4 years. Members of Congress are much more vulnerable to the reelection process. What is your best guess as to whether the Republicans in Congress might be willing to restrain the president?
Oh, Jeffrey, God bless you. I don't have a clue. I mean, the Republican Party, like the Democratic Party, but the Republican Party is trying to figure out what President-elect Trump might do as well. We all know that many Republicans didn't support him, not only in the primary, but they didn't support him in the final. And many of them ended up supporting him not because they liked him, but because they didn't like Hillary Clinton more than they didn't like Donald Trump. All that being said, everybody is trying to figure out exactly what the President-elect Trump will be doing, and no one really knows. I think this is one of the most unique candidates we've had in a while, and we'll have to wait and see. But I think you're right to be concerned. Many of us are deeply concerned because of some of the rhetoric that he used during the campaign, and I have become even more concerned because some of the people he has appointed. There have been, of the ones I can think of off the top of my head right now, there's none that I would have appointed. And, you know, there are some that are better than others, or at least maybe, but we'll have to wait and see. I will tell you that, no, I don't think the Republicans are going to try to rein him in. If anything, I think some House Republicans are going to say whatever he does isn't enough. And so, and then they will have their own internal fights. There'll be those who say he doesn't do enough. There'll be those who say he's just right. And they'll have their fights. The problem is, for Democrats, we're the minority. In the House, the majority rules, period. In the Senate, if we can keep 40 senators together on many issues, not all, but many issues require 60 votes. There are many that don't, but many of them do. If we can do that, we can hold the line on a bunch of these things. But the truth is, the battle for the next 2 years, as far as I'm concerned, is for the hearts and minds of the American people, so that 2 years from now they can elect a Congress that will provide exactly the kinds of checks and balances that you're talking about. But that's kind of the best hope we have for the next 2 years, is maybe he won't be as bad as we fear. Maybe he will. And if he is, then the truth is, the best thing we can do is elect different people in 2 years to provide that checks and balances.
We have time tonight for one more question, and we do apologize if we could not get to your questions, but you will have an opportunity to leave a voicemail for the congressman at the end of this call. And our last question is from James, who would like to talk about public education. James, your question?
Thank you, Congressman. This is a really, really good idea. I hope you do more of it. And, in fact, you've almost answered my questions already. So the final question is, I think Massachusetts still has a pretty good education system. I studied civics and history here. What can you do with the other blue state Congress people and senators to try to get more people to study physics and to be able to understand what the Constitution and the laws are about, how the government works? I think a lot of propaganda has been used in this election, and it showed a lot of ignorance about what our government's like.
God, I couldn't agree with you more, James. I usually find that it's the old adage, the empty barrel makes the most noise. And when it comes to the Constitution and people waving around, it's like, you've got it in your pocket. Did you read it? And if you read it, did you read it the way hundreds of thousands of people have read it before you for many different things? There's still lots of things to debate, but there are some things that are unequivocally clear, at least to me. For instance, the ability to declare war. The Constitution is very clear. You cannot declare war without the House of Representatives saying so. They're the ones who declare war. But that has been ignored for many, many times over history. All that being said, I will tell you that you may not like this, but I have been doing my best to keep the federal government out of education because I think Massachusetts' system is pretty good, especially compared to other states. What I don't want is the federal government coming in and dumbing down the Massachusetts system. Now, I have my problems with our system as well. Actually, the teaching of civics is one of them. I actually don't think that they do enough of it, but that's a different issue. And I think the last thing you really want is to have the federal government setting the standards or setting the curriculum or anything else. I really think, especially at this point in history, you wouldn't be happy with the results. So for me, my issue is more towards the state and to try to keep the federal government out of it. I'm scared to death of the woman that he just appointed, one of his billionaire friends, to head the Department of Education. She has a long history, as far as I'm concerned, about not being interested in educating all children or accepting all children as having full potential. She has, from what I know of her history, she's been pretty clear in picking winners and losers. This child can get an education and that child, that's just too bad. And I couldn't disagree with that more. So, honestly, I think you have to look to the states for the next couple of years. I hope that Washington doesn't provide any answers because I'm afraid the answers would be very bad.
That's all we have time for tonight. Thank you very much for joining us. We're sorry if we could not get to your question, but you will be able to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. And I know the Congressman would like to make a few brief closing remarks. Congressman?
Thank you very much, Charles. And again, I want to thank everybody who was on this call. I know a lot of people are on it for a few minutes, and a lot of people stay for the whole thing. But nonetheless, it's the best I can do to reach out to 750,000 people as I make these calls on occasion and listen to you and also give you an opportunity to ask me questions. I think that the district that I'm fortunate enough to represent is pretty uniform on our embracing democracy. I use the small d for that. We believe that government can play a positive role and should play a positive role in people's lives. And I will tell you that, number one, thank you for being involved. Thank you for being on the phone call tonight. And thank you for your support of me and the issues that we fight for. And like you, I have concerns about the future, and I can only tell you that I will never give up, and I hope that none of you ever do, that sometimes when we see adversity and we have a few setbacks, the only thing we can do is just recommit ourselves to double down on the fight, and that's what we're going to do. So, and I also hope that some of my concerns are ill-founded. I pray that President-elect Trump will become the greatest president in the history of America and prove my concerns wrong. If he does, I'll be the first one to say it. If he doesn't, I'll be the first one to commit myself to the fight. But anyway, thank you all very much for joining me tonight, and have a good, pleasant rest of the evening.